Good afternoon, everyone. This is Julie McCarty, Knowledge Management Specialist with the USAID Bureau for Food Security. And we're about to get started with our closing webinar for the Ag Exchange on aligning U.S. government research investments to the U.S. government global food security strategy. I'm just going to give a quick intro to the webinar room for those of you who have joined, and then I'll be passing it off to our speakers. So first, I just wanted to let you know that the chat box is your main way of communicating today. So please do introduce yourselves. Let us know where you're joining from. And also, you're welcome to ask ask questions throughout the event.
Keep going.
Using the chat box, and we'll be pausing at 2 points for Q&A. I also just wanted to point out on the left side of your screen, you can download the PowerPoint that you'll see today. And also in the little links box on the left of your screen, you'll see in the middle there's a link to a survey. For those of you who joined the Ag Exchange, we would be very grateful if you would fill out that survey and help us improve future Ag Exchange discussions. And let us know if you'd like to stay in touch regarding the development of the research strategy under the GFSS. All right, so we have a lot to get to today, so I'm going to go ahead and pass the mic over to the chair of BIFAD, Brady Deaton, who will be moderating this event today. So Brady, I'll pass it to you.
Julie, thank you. Thank you very much. And hello, everyone. You're tuning in to the wrap-up session for Ag Exchange, as Julie indicated, aligning research investments to the global food security strategy. I'm Brady Deaton, chair of BIFAD, and I really welcome all of you to this closing webinar. The last 3 days has seen an incredibly rich discussion that probably surprised many, as it did me, in its depth and breadth of coverage. We had over 400 registered participants from over 35 countries, and a total of over 800 comments made across the discussion threads. And that's really outstanding, with some of tremendously in-depth, with a lot of reference material being provided as well. So I want to thank everyone who participated in the exchange, and also to thank the organizers, especially those who facilitated the sessions, for the time and participation and the amazing job that you have done. This final session will be live audio for the next hour and a half, and is designed to summarize the key takeaways from the Ag Exchange. I'll be introducing Rob Bertram, Chief Scientist of the Bureau for Food Security, for some opening comments, and then we'll hear short summaries of the four themes from four USAID presenters. Nora Lapitan will talk about criteria for focusing U.S. government research investments. Nora is Director of the Research Division in the Office of Agricultural Research and Policy. The nutrition research opportunities will be presented by John Bowman, Program Area Lead for Nutrition and Safe Foods in the Office of Agricultural Research and Policy. Then agricultural and economic growth research opportunities will be presented by Jerry Glover, the Program Area Lead for Sustainable Intensification in the Office of Agricultural Research and Policy. And then resilience research opportunities will be led by Greg Collins, Director of the Center for Resilience. After that, those both BIFAD members present today, Dr. Gabisa Jeta, Pamela Anderson, and Carrie Fowler, will offer some insights and reflections on their participation and the ideas they've been exposed to over the last 3 days. And finally, we'll hear from Sheila Roquit, Director of the Office of Agricultural Research and Policy, about next steps in the research strategy alignment process and how the input from the Ag Exchange will be used. And we'll hear that before we adjourn today. I want to encourage participants to use the chat features that Julie just went over to ask questions or make comments, and we'll be pausing a few times to read these aloud and reflect on them as we go forward. With that, Rob, may I turn to you, Rob Bertram, Chief Scientist of the Bureau for Food Security, for some opening comments.
I just want to add our vote of thanks and appreciation to Brady's comments. We really appreciate working with the BIFAD. Brady, along with Pamela Anderson, Gabisa Ejeta, and Carrie Fowler, have all been active participants. And this really took me back, actually, to 2010 and 2011, when we similarly worked with BIFAD to engage the global research community to develop the Feed the Future research strategy, which APLU, the Association of Public and Land Grant Universities, played a very important part. And it also struck me that I think we had close to 400 participants, which is about the same number of participants we had in the series of meetings and such that we did back in 2010 and 2011. So it's great to see that we've again reached a large community that spans the globe. I think that research strategy was part of an overall transformation in how we approached food security and the challenges of solving extreme poverty, reducing hunger, and improving nutrition under Feed the Future. And in a sense, last year, when Congress, by a huge margin, passed the Global Food Security Act, I think we got a vote of endorsement from our leaders on Capitol Hill and in the executive branch. And the strategy then that was developed, the strategy that's going to be developed for the research this time is going to build significantly, I think, on the strategy we had under Feed the Future. That strategy, I think we discussed it the other day, so I won't repeat the key parts of it, but the main difference being that this time we have a new framework that adds, as we spoke about over the last few days, resilience and a expanded understanding of nutrition. So this week's Ag Exchange was again a way to update our thinking, to draw from all the partners and others who have been part of the last 6 or 7 years of work under the Feed the Future research strategy and translate that into a forward-looking approach for the Global Food Security Strategy and the Global Food Security Act. A lot of things haven't changed. We've learned a lot. I think we've been refining things all along, and we'll continue our whole-of-government approach. We'll continue to partner in catalytic ways with the public and private sectors, with the NGO sector, both here in the United States, but also around the world. And I think, very importantly, we'll continue to focus on evidence-based approaches so that we can not only make strategic choices, but then show that those choices are paying off in really strategic ways. So thank you again to all of you, and appreciate again, you know, the results of that will come out of this, and we look forward to that leading to research outputs that can really be picked up and run with by development partners all over the world and certainly across the Global Food Security Act implementation. Thank you. Thanks, Brady.
Thank you, Rob. And I believe we're going next to Nora Lapitan, am I right, new Research Division Chief? And she'll summarize the discussions on criteria for focusing relevant U.S. government research investments.
Yes, that's right. Thank you, Brady.
Thank you, Brady. Welcome, everyone. This is Nora Lapitan. Thank you for joining us today. I want to thank all of you for contributing your thoughts and insights to the online exchanges in the past 3 days. So I'm going to summarize our main key takeaways for the first session, which was on focusing research investment to address the key objectives of the global food security strategy. And again, just to remind you, those objectives include sustainable economic ag-led growth, strengthening resilience, and improving nutrition. I would also like to thank my colleagues Tyrell Cahan and Lourdes Martinez-Romero who worked with me in following the conversation. So in the back, there were note takers and we all had to gather all the insights that you have contributed. So there were two main themes under this topic which you're looking at on the slide, and I will discuss them sequentially. We had a very robust discussion under this topic, and in the interest of time, I'll keep my comments at a high level and highlight ones that received a lot of attention, including our own. So, so the first topic in this area was looking at the potential for technology adoption and scalability. So a lot of you said that these are important considerations when choosing research investments. So one of the threads around this topic was the importance of establishing impact pathways. So envisioning not only the research outputs, but also the dissemination pathways and how those techniques will reach scale. It is also important to consider the opportunities in science within the context of where the application of technologies matter the most. So here we need to consider not only the farmer constraints, but also what triggers decision making for farmers to adopt a particular technology. Considerations of the impact of technologies on male and female farmers is going to be very important. So for example, asking ourselves, will a technology empower women farmers and result in equity and inclusiveness? In other words, we need to consider possible interventions and approaches from a systems perspective lens, taking into account the context within those systems. So in GFSS, resilience is added as one of the objectives. And to address resilience, it's important to consider risk alongside the consideration of investments in technology development. So one of the ways to do this is to connect the technology agenda with social protection investments. The last topic that got a lot of attention is considering institutional capacity building to achieve sustained impact. So considering all the comments together, there were many more that I will not be able to discuss in 5 minutes, but the main takeaway is this, that overall we need to be strategic in prioritizing public investments and look for opportunities for private sector engagement. So with regard to opportunities in science and research, our main key takeaways have to do with research to help us understand what works in technology uptake and adoption. In other words, how can we better understand the dissemination pathways of technologies? What makes adoption of some technologies successful, and how can that information be shared? So under this topic, two that I would like to highlight in terms of opportunities are big data and information sharing platforms. So while big data approaches have been used in data-intensive disciplines such as genomics and sustainable intensification, the idea around this centered around using big data approaches to capture technology adoption, trends, and possibly emerging technology needs. The other one is the use of novel tools and approaches to capture technology needs and adoption. So, for example, one that was mentioned was hyperspectral imaging with or without remote sensing as a way to collect data on adoption rates and scaling, particularly on land area planted under new crops and technologies. Another interesting insight was to use crowdsourcing approaches to help reveal farmer agroecological knowledge gaps and information needs doing surveillance of pests and diseases and track and forecast yield trends. So these tools will help with monitoring and learning, which can inform decisions about strategic research investments. So those are our key takeaways, and I welcome your questions and comments. I will now hand over the mic to John Bowman.
Okay, good afternoon, everybody. This is John. I'm with the Bureau for Food Security, and I'm summarizing the nutrition session. As you can see, we had six topics that were up for discussion: dietary diversity, water and wash, food safety, nutrient-dense foods and partnerships, social behavior change, communication, and kind of the latest and greatest research innovations. We had close to 200 posts, and you can see that the posting was fairly well distributed over these topics. The research innovation one was the most popular, but I think an important takeaway here is if you look at the water and the wash, kind of the low participation level, this is kind of emblematic of a larger issue we have in that all the work we're doing in trying to build agricultural nutrition linkages to get good nutrition outcomes through agriculture, we're not really having a good interaction with the WASH community. And then topically across all of the conversations that we had throughout this session, there's general agreement that we need to highly reinforce social behavior communication change, dietary diversity, and include more work on animal source foods. Now, in terms of the summary, I'm not going to have time to go over all the six topics. Essentially summarized by the fact that there were three cross-cutting issues across all six. More work on multi-sectoral uptake of the actual recommendations, and then consumption patterns. So I'm going to go through those three now. Next slide, please. So in terms of multi-sectoral approach to this problem, still a lot of feeling that our research trials in nutrition and health should be fully co-integrated with agricultural projects instead of just simple coordinated co-location of projects. The co-location aspect is considered just to be weak and not enough. If we do cross-sectoral interventions, these are going to require a lot more time and patience initially, but over the long haul, we'll get a much more synergistic effect. Also, we need to pay more attention to the area of the One Health interface, where human and animal health, environmental stewardship, and natural resource management are deeply intertwined in terms of getting human nutrition outcomes and benefit. And we found out that this agricultural nutrition interface would highly benefit from a lot more engagement with veterinarians and animal scientists. Everyone agreed that also that the breeding for animal source foods, breeding animal source foods for higher nutrient content is a highly overlooked area. We could approach this much as we're doing with breeding more nutrients into crops through the Harvest Plus programming. And also just the effect of zoonotic disease interactions with nutrition and health. We need a lot more help with veterinarians and the animal science community on that. Next slide. In terms of the takeaway on uptake of technologies and recommendations, the key weakness here was that we're not doing enough work in this area of social and behavioral communication change. We need more nutrition education focused on incorporating the nutrient-dense foods into the traditional meals. We're having relatively good success on traditional nutrition interventions such as breastfeeding, that kind of thing. But in terms of nutrient-dense foods, we need to figure out how to better do the messaging. Also, what a lot of interesting conversation on what is the best age for messaging. And a lot of people felt that we were overly targeting older populations, and we need to much more target youth correctly, even down to the elementary and secondary school level. We also have to remove this kind of Western savior complex we have about our beneficiaries. These beneficiaries in the smallholder households, we have to perceive them more as actual customers in a private sector-driven food system. And we'll get a lot better results in nutrition if we do that. Policy was also considered to be an area highly needy of more research. The basic aspect here is that weak nutrition policy at the national level is currently undermining the rollout of our best agricultural nutrition-related interventions. Last slide. Then we have to think about consumption patterns. We have kind of very poor understanding of what our households are choosing to buy and sell. We need to understand better how price, income, nutrition, availability, perishability, and social taboos interact to determine the household-level choices that are being made. We have to keep in mind that increased income is not directly proportional to improved nutrition. We can go down that slippery slope of more income leading to intake of junky foods. And if you talk to some of the best nutritionists in the best universities, they simply make the statement like this. We just don't have a good handle on household-level food consumption. We really don't know what they're eating in the urban household or the rural household. Animal source foods, everyone's agreeing more work is needed, but what's the actual frequency needed? One egg a day, one egg per week, what do you actually need in terms of, you know, getting a child over the hump of a bad malnutrition situation? And finally, on metrics, current metrics are doing a poor job of assessing this household-level consumption pattern and whether or not we're really achieving diet diversity. And even when we think we are achieving diet diversity, we don't really know if improved diet diversity is really giving us a better health outcome. Finally, we need better metrics on income. What income levels are needed to achieve better nutrition health outcomes? And what is the level of affordability needed so that nutritious food can actually enter the household and make a difference? Thanks a lot.
So thank you, John. That was really fascinating, and I'm sure we'll get a lot of feedback from people who are listening. So now we're going to move on to the next session, which was the agricultural-led economic growth research. And our presenter is going to be Jerry Glover, the program area lead on sustainable intensification. Over to you, Jerry.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks, John, and everyone. I certainly want to echo others' appreciation for the facilitators, note takers, and so on. Certainly made our jobs much easier in doing this smoothly. We had five different question threads on agriculture-led economic growth. We've kind of distilled the responses into three broad categories, though, because there was so much interrelationship between those three questions. We often got responses about several questions in one question thread. The first broad category is on research to improve productivity. There was strong support for the idea that we need to increase productivity in many of the regions in which we're working, whether we're measuring it as yields or economic returns or even efficiency of nutrient inputs and so on. So there was wide appreciation for that. But there was fairly consistent feedback that we do need to use a systems approach, essentially going beyond production of a specific crop, but the system overall. And this even includes looking up and down the value chain, for example, on post-harvest handling and so on, to ensure that the quality, quantity, and value of production is increased. There was also nice discussion around the different types of farmers and the need to appreciate that not all farmers are the same, not all have the same capacity to take on new technologies or management practices, and studying what the differences are and what the different needs are is needed to improve productivity for a wider group of people. And remember, on agriculture-led economic growth, we mean more inclusive and environmentally sustainable. So identifying the different farmers, the different resources they have available is critical to achieving that wider objective. And that led into many people supporting greater work to increase on-farm diversification, to increase the quality and value of what's produced. So, of course, all that calls for more interdisciplinary research approaches. And I will say, you know, overall, I think we touch on all those issues in different ways. I think now it'll be up to us to identify, you know, where we strengthen our current efforts, how we tweak it a little bit to ensure those approaches are better addressed. The second broad category that was identified was on how to improve technology adoption. That's on the second slide. Thank you. And again, you know, people were very aware of the fact that technology adoption doesn't just happen on an individual farmer basis, but really needs to include quite a few stakeholders beyond the farm, take into better consideration of the private sector, those providing the inputs, and also better linkages to the larger development projects. We have to remember many of our research activities are relatively small, so we're directly interacting with a relatively small number of farmers, even though often it runs into the tens of thousands. You know, our impact we want to have is on population scales, millions of people. So, and that, making the connections with the development, the larger development projects is critical. And of course, ensuring that farmers are engaged throughout the entire process. The third large area that we identified was on the enabling environment, the larger environment that includes how people have access to credit, the infrastructure by which they get their goods to market, the government regulations that really influence a household decision making in terms of what they adopt, how they use it, and their access to markets. So it was pointed out that we need better understanding of the specific, not just national, but also local regulations, formal and informal, that influence access to land, ability to produce a wider range of goods and services. Another critical area people identified was around financing. How are people using money? How are they distributing money? What's their access to financing? And how does that play across regions, not just within local or even national level, but in the wider region? One topic was looking to improve the harmonization of the regulations across areas. I think one good example is, for example, in our seed systems, improving how one country interacts with another country in terms of approving seeds that can be commercialized and sold, reducing some of those barriers to certification and approval processes is very important. Of course, that extends well beyond seeds, includes fertilizers and other equipment. And then, of course, you know, the idea of the private sector and the enabling environment was brought up in very different contexts and in different ways. But improving our understanding of that, what's the connection between improved and enabling environment that benefits the smallholders, but including the connections to the private sector. Now, you know, it's as I said on that first point, we touch on many of those issues within our current research. So I think it'll be really an interesting discussion and perhaps struggle to determine the right balance, the right focus, and the right emphasis. But the conversations that came out of this effort, I think, are really beneficial to our effort moving forward. So thanks to everyone. And I now turn it over to
Greg Collins,
On resilience.
Thanks, Jerry. Thanks a lot. I think one important thing to note before I get into this is a lot of what Jerry has already talked about, what John has talked about, are definitely related to resilience, feed into resilience, are sources of resilience. But the elevation of resilience in the global food security strategy is forcing us to think of beyond how we previously conceived of risk management resilience. And I think that's how we tried to organize some of the questions for this session. Beginning with a question around measurement, and I think there has been tremendous advancement over the last 4 or 5 years in measuring resilience. I'm thinking back to the time when people were arguing over what was the right outcome that served as a proxy of resilience, to now a deeper understanding that resilience isn't an outcome at all, but rather a set of capacities that are realized in relation to a variety of shocks and stresses, and then through that we can assess how those capacities mitigate or moderate the impact of those shocks and stresses on various outcomes of interest, whether it's nutrition, productivity, food security, poverty, etc. So there has been advancement in the measurement space, but it's really been focused at sort of the household and community measurement level. And even in the way USA defines resilience and the way it's articulated in the global food security strategy, it's very clear that we conceptualize resilience as existing at multiple scales, from individuals and households to communities and systems and countries. And those systems could be market systems, ecological systems, social systems. But our measurement work hasn't kept step. And I think one area of research is a much more refined way of measuring sort of systems-level resilience capacities as a complement to our measurement at other scales. I also think there's a tremendous demand from governments for support on resilience measurement, in part because measuring resilience is one way people begin to understand what the heck we're talking about when we use that term. So I think, getting beyond the sort of very, very complex approaches to resilience measurement to practical uses that policymakers can then take up and implement is going to be critical. The second point here is about prioritizing investments in social protection and market systems. And I think this is a key aspect, and certainly of our learning about how to approach resilience, is it isn't about a single sector intervention, but it's about thinking about risk broadly, thinking about the different tools that need to be brought to bear. Certainly social protection plays a key role, and in particular, the emergent research on shock-responsive social protection, that is, social protection safety nets that are able to expand when shock events occur to lessen the impact on households. There is a point on this slide at the bottom about a trade-off between productivity goals and resilience goals, and I think there has been a tendency to think about it that way, but if we think about the complex risk environments in which we're working, I think a better way to think of it might be we can't achieve these productivity goals without building people's resilience capacities, given the complex compound risk environments in which we're working. Okay, so the next slide points to another emergent area of research that I think is critically important around behavioral development and social cognitive research. I want to focus in on a particular sort of subset of this, and that's some evidence that's emerging around the role of aspiration, social capital, or the ability to lean on other households, women's empowerment and overall empowerment as sources of resilience that transcend our sort of sectoralized view of the world. So we've got an initial sort of set of applied research that points to how important these are. I think we need additional research, and the discussion definitely reflected a need for additional research in this space. But the huge leap here is how do we make the leap from, yes, aspiration, social capital, and empowerment are important, to how we actually strengthen those social psychological factors through programming. So there's an applied angle to that for sure. The next area of discussion during the exchange was on financial systems, and in particular the role of insurance. I had a good opportunity earlier today to listen to Michael Carter and Alain Dejanvry present on the sort of lessons learned on index-based livestock insurance or index-based agricultural insurance. And one of the key takeaways that Alain made, and I thought was really, really sort of a key takeaway that came out of this ag discussion, was a need not to think about silver bullets here, but rather think about the broad set of tools that include but are not limited to insurance in terms of risk management. And there were some good examples given of, yes, insurance, but also emergency credit, the role of shock-responsive social protection. So I think there really is this move toward thinking about risk management in a very broad way and not thinking about single tools. Again, I think it's incumbent on us to show through research the advantage of a more comprehensive way of thinking about and approaching risk management to the governments we're working with, who, frankly, just like us, are split into bureaus, departments, and ministries, each of which is handling a slice of risk, and no inherent institutional body that's bringing that all together. And then the final point that really, I think, had a tremendous response on the exchange was talking about livelihoods and livelihood diversification. Jerry spoke a little bit to on-farm diversification, but I think what's being asked here is really a call for a sort of broader conceptualization of the sort of heterogeneity of pathways, sustainable pathways out of poverty, that are available to different households and communities. And I think one thing about the Global Food Security Strategy is it does a much better job than the prior strategy of recognizing that heterogeneity. It's absolutely true that a significant number of the farmers we work with are going to buffer risk by doing better in farming, better production, better links to market, the ability to accumulate assets, income, purchase insurance. But there's also a significant number of households with different asset profile, different resources, even different aspirations, who are already stepping a foot out of agriculture, not just out of production, but even out of agriculture altogether, or moving out entirely. So there is a need to think about not only diversifying on-farm or within agriculture, but diversifying livelihood risk profiles, including off-farm and outside of agriculture, particularly as it relates to climate risk. I think this issue about youth is incredibly important that came up in the exchange. We need to really come to grips with, yes, there are youth that want to become farmers and see it as a business, but there are a lot of youth that are conglomerating in urban centers that see a different pathway for themselves. So the opening up of multiple pathways and how to do that is a critical research question. I think I will leave it there and pass back to Rob.
Thanks very much, Greg. These were all great summaries, and I think now we turn it back to you, Brady.
Yes, thank you, and Nora, John, Jerry, and Greg. Excellent presentations, just very rich. And Julie, we were going to pause here for a moment, I believe, for any questions from the chat box coming in. And let me say, I am conscious of time also, but we certainly want to make this as interactive as possible. Julie?
Thank you, Brady. We had a question come in from Mark Varner that I thought I would raise. He said that the focus of this consultation was a realignment of the research agenda and not program implementation, but there were many postings in the Ag Exchange that were focused on implementation. Do we consider this to be an indicator that more research is needed on program implementation itself?
Okay, would members, any of the panelists that have been up so far, Rob, want to address that question?
So, you know, in a lot of areas of development, we have what we call operational research. The health sector is particularly known for that. I like to think that one strategy on this that we have used, and I invite my colleagues to comment on this as well, or others online, is we try not to silo research at the level of actual implementation on the ground. So in other words, we try to build social science into the innovation labs when they're working on the ground so that there's you know, always something in view, and in some of the cases, some of the labs are directly focused on some of these social science approaches to understanding transformations and decision-making and asset management. I think Greg's comments, you know, raised the point of, well, to what extent do we have new understandings from resilience that might suggest we look at those somewhat differently, change them, possibly do more of them, you know, just this kind of thing. So I think this is the sort of thing that we're going to be asking in a number of different respects. Let me turn to my colleagues and see if any of them would like to comment. Anyone amongst the BIFAD members wish to comment?
I will. This is Brady. I would just add that to Mark's question, I think I speak for myself, but I think other members of BIFAD also may share the thought that knowledge generation occurs at all levels, and the program implementation involves a lot of both social science understanding on the one hand and the integration among scientific areas as programs are being implemented and administered. And there are times that the organizational, legal framework, institutional framework lends itself very well to important research questions that we should undertake. So I would not want to isolate it from an ongoing concern about appropriate research that may be needed. That's from my perspective.
You know, Brady, that's really helpful, and it also makes me think of something else. In the Bureau for Food Security, we have a Markets, Partnerships, and Innovation Office. In other words, what you're getting at, I think, is that there's a learning agenda and an innovation agenda, yes, in our research side, but also in our development implementation work that Mark was speaking about. So, yeah, I think making those connections robust and being mindful about that learning and the interface between, particularly the interface between the stuff we call research and the stuff we call development, is really important.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. You know, given the time frame, my sense is, Julie, if there's a question burning, I wouldn't want to eliminate it, but perhaps we should turn now to members of BIFAD, and then these questions also can be introduced in at a later time. Is that okay, or do you have something you want to bring up right now?
I think that's fine, Brady. We can go ahead and move to BIFAD, and then we'll take some more questions at the end.
Okay, great. And the first part of the program, let me thank all of you. This has been absolutely rich presentation. And my comments will be very brief, and I mainly wanted to emphasize that the discussions that I've seen over the last 3 days have been just absolutely phenomenal. And I know that other members of BIFAD who are moderating and interacting with various groups around the world will make this a continuing very rich discussion. We heard a lot of discussion of interdisciplinarity, and I would want to emphasize that. But I was rather surprised at how significant that was in each of the areas being addressed here. These strategies for resilience, technology adoption and identification of appropriate technologies, decision-making at the household level, all these were very, very critical in an interdisciplinary context as we think about research themes. And I think Greg spoke a moment ago to what I saw anyway as a key challenge emerging from this is that of coalescing the very rich discussion that we've had over these last 3 days and identifying the leading edge for research. Mark Varner's emphasis on programmatic implementation is very important that we continue, Rob Bertram, the discussion we were just having, I think, as we sort this out. And the way in which this then relates to specific groups, certainly to youth, the multiple pathways for youth, becomes very important because in youth lies our future. And we have to be concerned at all times about how that transforming model that we're working with is engaging and challenging the next generation that's coming along. So those were key points, at least, that really hit me as I listened and have heard your discussions. Let me now turn to Pamela Anderson and ask Pamela to give us her summary. And Pamela, as you know, I think was Director General Emeritus of the International Potato Center. Pamela, welcome.
Thank you, Brady. Yeah, I just want to echo what most people have said, that the 3 days were really enjoyable and very, very rich. I helped Jerry Glover moderate part of the Ag-Led Economic Growth session, but I participated and followed in all three of the discussion topics. So I wanted to make just a kind of an additional comment to what Jerry shared and then focus more on what I saw cutting across the three areas. I think one of the things that surprised me is not what I heard, but what I did not hear. In the ag-led economic growth section, I really did not hear discussion on what we could call the traditional ag productivity research agenda, how we protect past productivity gains, the changes we need to make in research on genetic gains going forward. And that surprised me a lot. But what was interesting about it is really speaking to what Jerry was talking about. I think what people were calling for, at least what I heard, was that we need more research to increase the efficiency and the impact of that traditional productivity agenda. And so things like, yes, segmentation, contextualization, and much better targeting. Who are we actually trying to improve productivity for? What do they need? What do they want? So we can get sharper in terms of our methodology development and our product development and the uptake. More work on economics. There were some important commentaries on in the context of scaling up and scaling out. We need economic analyses so that we can really understand the cost effectiveness of different alternative products and actions across the portfolio. More market research, more gender research. So there was a real strong call for research that is enabling beyond that traditional productivity agenda. It was very interesting to me. As I listened across these different topics, there were a couple of themes that emerged across all of them. And I suspect that as AID digs into the details of this, they will ferret out more, and it will be good fodder for reflection. The two that I picked up on the most, of course, were gender and particularly women's empowerment. It wasn't addressed in the depth that I had wished or hoped, particularly in the section on resilience, but it was there, you know, and looking at what that would look like if we look at it in a real cross-cutting manner. The theme that was more interesting and came out, I think, more vocally was diversification. Jerry and Greg alluded to that already. So diversification to improve nutrition, to increase egg-based income, and as a resilience factor. The details of that, of course, are going to be local, so again, the need for contextualization. But one of the thoughts, and I think Rob actually voiced this during the exchange, was perhaps it's time to think much more strategically about the role of global research in understanding and addressing risk factors in the diversification of small farmer, fisher, and pastoralist systems. So that cross-cutting theme of diversification. So there are a couple of the what's. But the other big thing that I think I was hearing as I was following along, and this may be a little bit of what Mark was alluding to just now and picking up on, was not just what research we need going forward, how to realign the what, but really a lot of conversation around the how. How we undertake our research and how we frame our research agenda. The real discussion that just kept coming back and back to me is what I would probably call our collective struggle with compartmentalization. So the compartmentalization between social and natural sciences, although people did point out that's getting better, between ag and health scientists and professionals, between the public and private sector, across the interface of research and scaling and utilization, and now, as you just pointed out too, you know, research and development. So a real call, in a sense, that we shift much more intentionally from compartmentalization to integration and convergence. You know, how would we think about that? And I think there's a lot of merit, you know, to do some deep thinking for the colleagues at AID, you know, as a major global donor. Are there innovative ways of allocating and granting funds such that you could enable or force that convergence? This is the last comment I really have, the other shift that I heard people calling for was a shift in how we frame our research agendas, specifically the need to look from much more from the demand side instead of our historical focus on production and supply side research. And those calls manifested, for example, in suggestions for much more of a market-driven approach and for a move from our historic commodity-framed research agendas to more of a consumer demand set of research agendas. So I just heard a lot of discussion, and I'm not sure I'd call it implementation, but really questioning, can we accelerate and make more progress, have more impact, if we really take on how? And some of that is going to be involve research questions, and some of that is going to perhaps be in the hands of AID as you think about, you know, how you condition the money, how you allocate the money, and what you can do to really drive some of those changes in how we do research. So that's really what I wanted to share, Brady. It was a wonderful 3 days, and I would thank all the colleagues at AID and CADAD that spent so much time organizing this for us. Thank you.
Pamela, thank you very much. Superb summary, really. We look forward to further discussion on that. We'll now turn to Carrie Fowler, former Executive Director of Global Crop Diversity Trust. Carrie?
Thank you, Brady, and good afternoon, if you're in my time zone at least. I want to focus primarily on the topic that I co-facilitated with Rob Bertram on Tuesday, and that concerned the criteria for prioritizing research investments. I think the first thing to say would be that it appears that there's broad and general satisfaction with the criteria that USAID is using. If there are disagreements or difficulties, they probably arise in the area of the details or the implementation. But having said that, when you talk about criteria, you're really talking about something that's one level of abstraction removed from what people really want to talk about, which is what you're doing and or not doing. And it struck me that what we might want to do as perhaps USAID staff and BIFAD is to look at our existing criteria and see if they're complete enough to have at least encouraged a consideration of the different more substantive points that were raised during our discussions. I saw going across all of the discussions a lot of concern about scalability, about cost-benefit, and as Pamela just mentioned, about diversification. And I guess that really just reflects a great deal of concern about the importance of these issues and uncertainty, I suppose, about whether we're really handling them correctly. And then I wanted to mention a couple of points that I don't think got a lot of attention but really struck me as being quite important when they were raised. Someone on Tuesday raised the question of comparative advantage. What is USAID's unique role, its comparative advantage, and the cost-benefit of that? Second would be, are we positioned appropriately in terms of support to both long-term, long-term research and short-term? Are we dealing appropriately with those different types of research, and do we have criteria that helps us make those kind of decisions? And the third, which Nora mentioned earlier, was the topic of big data used to capture trends, adoption, emerging needs. I thought that was a really interesting comment and worth some consideration. And I would simply add to that sort of the opposite. What happens when we don't have very much information? We don't have very much data about a particular research area, a particular crop, perhaps, for plant breeding. Does that introduce some bias in our decision-making process that tends to distract us from perhaps worthwhile investments in those particular areas? And then finally, I guess the one surprise to me of something that didn't come up too much was the question of climate change and the extent to which we are paying attention to that and dealing appropriately with that, both in terms of mitigation and adaptation, given the fact that obviously it's going to affect virtually all aspects of all of our work. Again, I'll end up by thanking the staff, as everyone else has. Incredible discussion, really interesting, and something I think we're going to want to go back to and read over again and ponder. With that, back to you, Brady.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Excellent comments. We'll now turn to Gabisa Ejeta. Our final BIFAD member will be speaking here with us today. As Gabisa Ejeta is Distinguished Professor in the Department of Agronomy at Purdue University. Gabisa, turn to you. Gabisa Ejeta, are you on the line? Am I connected?
We can hear you, Brady. Gabisa, are you muted by any chance? We're not hearing your voice coming through.
I was afraid for a moment there. I was lost.
No, not you, Brady.
Not your sound.
If we don't have Gabisa, we can wait one more moment and see if he's... But it's possible we could...
Okay.
And if needed.
Well, if Gabisa breaks in, we will pause for him. And let me thank other members of the BIFAD for their discussions a moment ago. And why don't we go ahead then, Julie, and with other questions that you may have accumulated that have come in online, share some of those and we can have discussion on those.
Sure. Well, perhaps first we had a few comments come in on nutrition, and I think John Bowman was interested in making a few comments. In particular, Deepa mentioned that nutrition research priorities also have to take into account that the incidence of overweight is also closely related to poverty and the dual burden of malnutrition. I don't know if you want to comment on that or anything else.
I'll try on that one a little bit later, but I wanted first to address Cynthia's commentary about, we do need more information on household consumption, but she raised this problem of interview fatigue amongst our beneficiaries. And I think in the discussions that we were having in the nutrition session, we just need better techniques. I think there's no doubt we have to get into the households, whether they're urban or rural, and ask questions and get data. The idea is, though, there may be, we need to do more out-of-the-box thinking in terms of having a better interaction with that beneficiary so they don't become fatigued, so it becomes a more worthwhile exercise, and we get better information. So this one comment that came up in discussion about, you know, treating our beneficiaries, you know, less in the perspective of, you know, this Western savior type approach, you know, and making more of an effort to treat our beneficiaries as consumers, no matter how poor they may be, but as consumers in a private sector driven world of food production, buying and selling. I mean, this is one thing we need to do. So I don't know in terms of how you actually, you know, when you get in the household, how you treat these folks more as customers versus, you know, you have to kind of put your idea of tree hugging and people hugging behind you and treat them a little bit more clinically as customers. We have to figure out ways to do that. And I think maybe that will, when they see that folks are there in the household interviewing them, you know, with the practical consideration of them as customers, maybe the situation will improve. Deepa's question was more about, you know, we do have to be concerned about, as income levels rise, we're going to have these problems with obesity and problems with, you know, non-communicable diseases, you know, cardiac problems with fat consumption and this kind of thing. So I think that's a really charged subject. I mean, we're well aware of this problem. Many will say that we just need to address the many people who are not, they're far from an obesity situation. They're on the threshold of dying. So, but you can trust me that nutritionists at AID are looking at both areas. Maybe we have to improve the balance more towards the obesity question. I mean, if our ag productivity, economic growth activities really do improve income to the point where their main problem is that people are buying too many, you know, instant noodles and cookies and soda pop in the rural areas, if that, you know, I'll be somewhat relieved if that becomes more the driving concern versus getting people, you know, away from the threshold of death. So others might want to weigh in on that, but I think we're aware of it, and we maybe need to do some thinking and strike a better balance.
John, thank you. Do any members of BIFAD, the board, want to address that issue? Otherwise, Julie, I would just ask if there are other key questions you want to bring forward that members of the board could respond to.
Sure. Well, I think this was partly addressed by everyone's comments, but I appreciated that our colleague Laura Senso at FinTrack pointed out that we are still accepting comments on the Ag Exchange through the end of the day tomorrow, through 5 p.m. Eastern Time.
Yes.
And, as such, were there any, the USAID staff or the BIFAD members recommend any more feedback on any particular questions that weren't fully addressed? Is there anything that you would like to see the community continue to comment on through the end of tomorrow?
Julie, the one point that I would just, this is Brady, I would call attention to was the absence of the discussion on PAP productivity, to use the phrase that Pamela Anderson used in traditional areas. Is that an area that more attention should be given to, or is there such an emphasis now on the other issues that were made about the contextualization, the implementation, the how, really? Does that really reflect what the feeling is out there, or is there some specific concern about PAP productivity? That was one question that came up. And then the absence of discussion, as Carrie mentioned, on climate change also. Are those issues longer term and therefore get less attention? Those were questions all that jumped in front of me anyway as I listened.
Julie, this is Pamela. Well, while it was brought up, I still think that the discussion across the topics on gender was quite weak. And so if people feel like actually responding a bit more in terms of the gender research agenda across the portfolio, I think that would be very helpful.
Yeah, this is Jerry Glover. I will say that our emphasis on gender issues in our research receives a lot more attention than the topic did on the chat discussion. However, it's somewhat covered in people encouraging us to, really find ways to understand the households, how the decisions are made, who they're made by, and what the priorities are. And in many ways, that takes into account the different viewpoints of different genders, and even including the different access to resources and so on. So it's a little bit wrapped up in there. I will say our research in general tends to focus much more on gender issues than the discussions did that I saw.
You know, Jerry, this is Rob Bertram, and I wanted to say that a similar case in point about the things that Pamela flagged and Carrie flagged and Brady seconded in terms of both the sort of leveraging the advanced science for productivity gains, including around meeting emerging threats. We have significant efforts on that. And then the second thing is the climate change piece has been very central. And what we've been, I think, thinking about a lot is how resilience and adaptation to climate challenges are going to continue to be emphasized. We may also, though, be talking about them in very much real time, and this reflecting the fact that so many of the areas where we're working are already climate challenged. But it is, I share the surprise that the members of BIFAD have, but it's also interesting because both of those themes were are very prominent in the current research portfolio and were emphasized under the Feed the Future research strategy.
And maybe, Rob, maybe that's why it didn't come up as prominently, because people feel that it's actually already getting the attention it needs, and so there's not that much realignment. But just kind of double-checking if that's how you feel, fine. But if there are things there, then they'd be great to bring forward.
And, Rob, the emphasis you gave to leveraging advanced science really speaks to the whole-of-government approach also, which you've continued to emphasize, and I think it's heartening to know that that will remain a very strong thrust, where USAID could perhaps provide some leadership in that synthesis from the more advanced science to those programmatic operational changes that we feel, that many feel are needed.
That's right, and Brady, one of the things, an organization that's not directly one of the Global Food Security Act agencies, but is very interested in the topics like this, is the National Science Foundation.
Yes, yes.
So we realize, in a sense, that the United States is almost uniquely positioned in the global community to really leverage this, including also from our private sector.
Yes, yes, excellent. Well, given the time here, we had set aside about 10 minutes at this point for discussion among board members. Given that this is really serving as a meeting of BIFAD. I did want to double-check, too, to see if Gabisa Jeta had, whether he is online at this point. Otherwise, Pamela, Carrie, and myself represent the board members that are with us, I believe, at this point. And let me just raise that issue then of opening the floor up for discussion among board members, and certainly we can bring in questions regarding from staff as well. So, Pamela or Carrie, may I turn to either of you if you want to make any specific comments? You've raised some excellent points in your summaries, which I thought were just right on target.
Well, Brady, this is Carrie. Could I mention something real quickly that I should have said before? But we had an excellent background research paper that was put on the table for all these sessions, and that was the paper by Prey, Masters et al. On impacts of agricultural research. And I simply want to say thank you to everyone involved in that, but also to commend it to anyone that might be listening. It's a great document that will help us, I think, in our fields for a long, long time. And one of the uses of that document we might consider is simply to take another look at the successful research that's been done in the past and ask ourselves, are there reasons why some of the success stories can't be repeated, or are there reasons why we're continuing to go in the wrong direction in some of the research that wasn't so profitable? So I think it was a big contribution to this whole discussion, and could continue to be.
Excellent point.
Bray, I have a couple of not observations as much as questions, maybe to kick back to Rob and Sheila and the USAID colleagues. Things that came up or that I thought I was hearing these past couple of days. One of them was a lot of conversation on targeting, and again going back to this need perhaps to do more segmentation. But you know, it'd be interesting to understand how much the AID team has really grappled with the segmentation and targeting. I mean, who are we really developing, you know, and delivering and working with? Who, you know, how are we trying to get at these impacts that we're getting at? Who are we targeting? And if they have, you know, not right now necessarily, but perhaps share that a little bit more explicitly with everyone. And if they haven't, how do we go about that? And the second point is landscaping. I have this sense, you know, after some of the euphoria that many of us felt tragically after the food price crisis, seeing attention, political and financial attention, come back to food security, it feels as if, you know, we're now going forward into an environment globally that might be constrained in terms of, you know, human and financial resources for research. And so synergies become even more important. So and I mean that in terms of synergies within the program, and we've talked about some of that today, you know, where can you get, you know, enhanced impact because it's appropriate and relevant across all of the objectives, but also synergy with other players. And so my question is, how much landscaping have you done? Because the rich, you know, calls and requests for research that came through, obviously, you know, there's not enough money in one agency to address all that. One of the ways of addressing it is doing landscaping to look at who else is doing that research, how do you partner? So the questions, how have you approached targeting, and, you know, can we get some more discussion as we roll forward on segmentation and targeting? And how have you approached landscaping, and what is that going to look like? So that's really all I had to ask and add at this point.
Excellent question. We want to entertain some discussion on that point at this time from reactions from Rob, Sheila, others, Nora in the earlier panel?
Brady, perhaps just a quick response on the segmentation of farmers, the types of farmers the different types of farmers. We do have actually quite a lot of research on that within our systems programs, in which different systems or different innovations have been developed based on the resource endowment and, as Greg previously referred, their aspirations. So, for example, in Malawi, two different types of maize legume systems for different types of households. And it was after extensive study on, you know, how many different types are there typically for the representative populations that we're targeting, and then, you know, how many different approaches do you need for those different typologies. And for those in Malawi, they identified two maize legume systems that would satisfy many of the populations Feed the Future's targeting. So that's just one example of using a lot of participatory research, looking at household decision making, household typologies that the scientists working directly with the farmers developed systems that seem economically viable, certainly increase productivity for two different sets of households. And one of the real limiting factors there was farm size. Smaller land areas, you're more restricted in what you can do. So
could I add to that, Jerry? You mentioned the farm size issue, which did come up a little bit in the course of our discussions, and it made me think of something that Shengen Fan, the Director General of IFPRI, talks about, and it sounds a little harsh, but I don't think it's meant that way. It's up or out. In other words, he's talking about the fact that some smallholders are probably going to diversify their livelihoods seeking jobs elsewhere, and I think, you know, a lot of our thinking in the resilience sphere looks at these multiple strategies, and this doesn't mean they give up their land necessarily. It may mean that there's ways to aggregate land at the community level in terms of investment. We think a lot about service provision in terms of land management, things like harvesting and irrigation and mechanization. We have a lot more evidence in this area in Asia than we do in sub-Saharan Africa, but certainly this is all tied in, and it really comes back to Pamela's flagging of this targeting issue, trying to understand the dynamics. A lot of people are thinking about this. I think, you know, we need to continue to grow that evidence base. But as people have better access to information, as infrastructure improves, I suspect people will be ingenious in many ways, not all of which we can predict, but we need to keep an eye on it. If I can make a very quick comment on the landscaping question that Pamela raised, I think we are all thinking about what are the outcomes right now that would do a couple of things. One of them is, what can we do that can really show that this is truly America's effort to address food security and hunger and undernutrition in the world, extreme poverty? And so there are other American players in this, and I think already talk a lot to them and work with them, but I think maybe that's something we're even trying to think more about, and maybe also how could we, are there ways we could analyze that to identify others that we ought to be talking to? I mean, traditionally our great strength has been with the university community, and that continues, and it's been incredibly robust and exciting under Feed the Future to see the innovation labs and many other engagements from that community. I then think that, and I'm sure Pamela would want us to do this as well, is then let's look beyond our shores. Well, one more thing, too, before we leave our shores, is we have a lot of community here that cares deeply about the people facing resilience issues. We have a whole side of USAID and a whole private voluntary organization, a rich vein in our country that reflects many, many good things and has a lot of knowledge and experience. I think maybe that's another area where really deepening, particularly in this resilience context, we can learn. And then beyond that, I was just going to say that let's look beyond our shores to see where else in the world we have that opportunity to find like-mindeds who recognize the synergies that could come by bringing our resources and perhaps even our programming together.
Rob, thank you so much, and thanks to everyone for the very thoughtful insights that you've brought forward. This is a good segue into the next segment here, which was
Mind if I interrupt for just one moment? I wanted to let you know that we do think Gabisa is back on the line, and he might have a few words to say.
Okay. Hello, Gabisa?
Yes. Hi, Brady.
Yes, we had wanted to give you a moment for your reflections on the sessions on the Ag Exchange that you participated in.
Yes. We had a good session this morning, and my sense was that particularly in the research section, the engagement was very good. I'm not sure how it went yesterday and the day before, if they had full participation in all the threads, but it was richer in our section in the research area, even though we didn't iterate with each other as much. There were several important points that came through, and that was very encouraging, at least an initial thought pieces that had come up and that could be pursued by those that would do further synthesis. But I wasn't sure if it's either the fact that this was the third day and people were dropping out, or whether or not we may not have the right sets of people contacted to have in the, particularly in those that are engaged in natural resource conservation and resilience area. The discussion, I thought, could have been richer, but again, the more important message that I wanted to share was that just one out of the five threads were the ones that we dealt on a lot more today.
Okay, Gabisa, thank you so much. And we will turn now to Sheila Rokit, Director of the Office of Agricultural Research and Policy in USAID's Bureau for Food Security, and she will be providing remarks about the next steps in the research strategy development process, something that we're very eager to listen to. Sheila?
Great. Thank you so much, Brady. As you noted when you started off this webinar in the very beginning, was how much traffic we actually got on this Ag Exchange, and I've been told it's actually the biggest one we've had yet. So I really want to thank everyone for their input. This is the input that we're getting from around the world is really important to us. Your thoughts and ideas that are helping us hone this strategy are of great use. For a moment, I just wanted to step back and reflect on the process that we've gone through to get to the point where we are today. And I'll describe briefly as well the path forward. So after we delivered the Global Food Security Strategy to Congress on October 1st, we held a number of consultative processes, many of which you'll see on the slide. These processes included working with colleagues across the U.S. government, including the 10 other departments and agencies identified in the Global Food Security Act, and many of our partners, including the U.S. universities that head up our innovation labs, as well as national, regional, and global partners in the places that we work around the world. We sought input from our field missions that coordinate our interagency work on the ground. And this e-consultation, of course, was a way for us to open this up globally for public input. This e-consultation concludes our formal information gathering process. And next, we will be sifting through all of the rich contributions that we've gotten over the past 8 months and put that into a draft of our research strategy that we will do in collaboration with our interagency colleagues and with inputs from the BIFAD members. Remember, I would like to remind people that the document that we will be producing is a very high-level document at the 30,000-foot level that will help guide these research investments across the 11 different departments and agencies. The more detailed level plans you'll find at the agency level as they develop their own implementation plans and implement their programs. So we expect to have the strategy completed this summer, and once it's completed, it will be posted publicly on the AgriLinks website and in other places. We will also share and disseminate the U.S. government strategy at public events. A few of those are noted on the slide. As Julie noted as well, there was a short survey that was emailed to you about this closing webinar, but in it you can indicate to us your interest in continued engagement as we go through the next phases of this strategy process. So please fill it out for those of you who want to remain engaged. Lastly, I would like to give a heartfelt thanks to the BIFAD members and our interagency colleagues for their leadership, sage advice, guidance, and ongoing support throughout this process. We really look forward to your continued engagement. As Brady and Rob noted, it took a lot of people to pull this together, the global village, if you will. This amazing team comprised research and development institutions and individuals around the world, as well as government, civil society, and the private sector. And personally, I would like to thank Sahar Moon and Rob Bertram at USAID for their unflagging leadership and passion for food security issues, not just around this ag exchange, but every single day. They keep us motivated and going in the right direction. So with that, Brady, I'd like to turn it back to you.
Sheila, thank you. That's a beautiful summary, and I echo thanks to all that you mentioned. And Julie and Sheila yourself, thanks for your role here today, and the panelists, Nora, John, Jerry, Greg, and Rob Bertram, particularly for your ongoing role that we've been so enriched by. I thank you. I particularly thank BIFAD members, board members that were able to participate in this, Pamela Anderson, Gabisa Jeta, and Carrie Fowler. The tremendous time, and I was able to observe this during the past 3 days, and the tremendous insight that you have shared with others around the world and in this discussion today. And it's delightful to know that this really was the biggest one yet. We always are intrigued by that. And with the interagency colleagues we have in place, really looking forward to further discussions of the whole of government approach that can really help shape the strategies for the future. So this really concludes the live audio session of the Ag Exchange. And I, in doing so, want to thank all members of the public for their engagement and participation in the events. Session presenters, facilitators, summarizers, it really represented teamwork of the finest, and I hope sets a pattern that we can continue as we go forward. Those of you in the Bureau of Food Security that I've mentioned already, along with Clara Coyne, Executive Director of BIFAD, Kristen Franklin and Julie, I mentioned your ongoing work from the beginning in the planning, as well as the other agencies that we have worked with, the USDA and APLU and others. This has made this a very rich discussion that I see as a model for so much dialogue that will continue in the future. It's an amazing team that you've brought forward. We want to continue that teamwork and really thank all the dedicated individuals that have made this possible. You'll be able to find minutes of this meeting on the USAID BIFAD website and the FACA database, at least no later than 90 days after the event. These discussion threads will be archived on the AgriLinks site. And while we're adjourning this meeting, the discussion threads will continue to be open, as I believe it was Julie said a few moments ago, through the close of business Friday, April the 21st. And I'll be thanking a broad list of people in my final posting on this process as well. So with that, thank you all for participating, and we're looking forward to this being the foundation for a very, very inspiring next few steps. So we're delighted with the process. Thanks to all of you again. Have a wonderful weekend, too.